It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to another episode of Continued Success. I'm the head guy at The Good Fight, Justin Clue, and with me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, Justin.
Phillies dropped 3 out of 4 to the Brewers, a series that knew had 4 games, first of all.
And it really did, and we felt all of them.
Once that revelation occurred, it was pretty much downhill from there.
As soon as we looked at the schedule.
Honestly, after the Phillies stole that first game, which does feel like they kind of just stole it at this point.
They did. That was a miracle.
Was that a kind of win at the beginning that gave you a vibe that this was a team that was really going to give the Brewers a run for their money for 4 games?
No, I didn't. I mean, that win was really nice, especially since it was way unexpected. But yeah, that they stole that one from the jaws of whatever. And we're not so lucky with the other ones. And as I said recently, both Jared Eichhoff and Zach Eflin were due for less than great starts.
Yeah, well, we certainly saw those. That.
I really didn't want them to happen together and in the same series.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also, on top of that, got a bad Aaron Nola start. He only lasted 3 innings in the series opener, gave up 3 earned runs, 5 hits. 3 walks. His ERA is down up to 4.86, and
not good.
And they had to patchwork that one together with a series of relievers, few of whom anybody is excited to see come into a game at this point. And then, the next day was the aforementioned Jared Eichhoff start. He lasted 4 innings, gave up 5 earned runs and 8 hits, as well as 2 home runs, and the Phillies 6-1 loss to the Brewers the following day. Then we followed that up with a 5-2 loss that featured the Jake Arrieta start. Jake Arrieta, I believe, had the longest start of any Phillies starter for this series. Correct me if I'm wrong. When he lasted 6 innings, but had a similar line of giving up 4 earned runs and 5 hits. Because yesterday during the matinee, it looked like it was going to be a little bit of a game. The Phillies were scoring, but as John Stolness phrased it yesterday, it felt like the Phillies had to bleed for every run they scored, whereas the Brewers were just kind of doing it at will. So I remember watching the Phillies take the lead in the third inning. They had runners on second and third, and there were no outs, but it cost them an out each time they scored a run, and it was just like, well, that's not a super productive way to go about this, especially against a team that's
not sustainable.
Managed to score, 5-6 runs at least in every game against you. And Zach Eflin, of course, only went 5 innings. So if you're doing the math at home, that's I'm trying to do it in my head. That's 18 innings, I believe, of pitching the Phillies received from their starting pitchers over 4 games. So 18 out of 36 innings.
Ultra.
Yay. Not great. Same stuff, really, as before, except now also the offense isn't hitting. So that's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, you can have pitchers that give up some runs if you have an offense that can stay with them. And the Brewers are just, they are better than the Phillies. We have found the team that is better than the Phillies, and it's the Brewers. There will be others that are better, and I think we're going to see a few of them as we go along during this road trip.
Yeah, that's sort of the
baton death march of a road trip.
That's kind of what makes this even more upsetting, is that this was the beginning of a stretch where the Phillies are playing a lot of really good teams, probably all the best team, all the good teams in the National League, really. And they started off winning that first game, and it was like, all right. I was similar. I didn't really feel like it was a win that said, like, all right, this team is making a statement. They're gonna, they know what they have to do over this stretch. It was really more like, all right, that's one. Let's see what happens tomorrow. And that, it turns out, was sort of the proper way to go about that, because they tomorrow never brought good news after that first game. And in doing so, really, you know, if you're a believer in momentum or just setting the tone, this was not the way to go about that before these, what, like 17 games against against good teams. I mean, really, even the timing against which they're playing some of these teams is just perfect. I mean, Dodgers have been good all year. The Rockies have come and gone a little bit. Same with Cardinals. They both flip-flopped a little bit as far as how they were looking. But I believe they're both on the up and up at the moment. But the Cubs especially are not a team anybody wants to play right now. And I do.
Then they see the Brewers again.
And then it's the Brewers again. So, yeah.
And the Cardinals were like, they managed to beat the Cardinals 2 out of 3 last time. But I don't think that will happen again.
Yeah.
God, and then it's the Dodgers. Why?
Well, Dodgers had like, they lost like, I don't know, I think like 5, 6, 7 games in a row earlier in April. And that's, other than that, they've pretty much had a sustained pattern of winning since the beginning of the season. Again, also a team nobody really wants to face. Least of all, a team that doesn't know even which part of itself it can rely on, because at the moment it's kind of none, you know, there's really no strength. Do you think of the Phillies as a good team when you see that, like, okay, look, they're clearly capable of breaking off 7 or 8 runs a night just because their starting pitching is a little less frequently capable of giving them 6, 7, 8 innings a night. But, you know, we haven't seen a lot of that, but the right time through the rotation, you've seen that, like, okay, Jared Eichhoff has looked good. Zach Eflin has looked good. You presume Aaron Nola will look good. Jake Arrieta, I'm kind of like, this is what we got. You know, he's going to give up a pile of hits, a pile of runs. Maybe he'll last into the 7th inning. That's kind of where I'm at with Jake Arrieta. And then that 5th spot is what? You know, it's not Nick Pavetta. It's not Vince Velasquez. Cole Irvin got the start last time and he looked pretty good. So I'm sure he'll get another shot given how precious a commodity good starting pitching is on this team. But
I think he starts tonight, actually.
There you go.
Against the Rockies.
So, you know,
trial by fire. Don't complain. Just
kind of doing this. But I mean, yeah, we keep saying, oh, this is a very good team that is also very flawed. But at what point does the very flawed part start subtracting from the very good? You know, like there's certainly such a thing as a good flawed team, but how good can the Phillies be when it seems like there can be a team wide shutdown at times, and we're seeing one right now.
Like this lineup was supposed to kind of inoculate the Phillies against that. There's supposed to be something always working, and maybe this is just a stretch where everyone, it's not like they've been through, what, 6 weeks of baseball? Wait, no, what part? I'm like, it's not the beginning of May anymore. They've been through almost 2 months of baseball. So, you know, it's, you know, guys are starting to feel it, you know. I don't know. Like, I don't know if I'd call the Phillies a good team. Like, they're not a bad team, but you can't be good and be inconsistent. Because if you're inconsistent, that means you're most likely more times bad than good. And like I'm on the Phillies baseball reference page, and I have this, you know, that game results graphed at the top of the page, right above all the faces. And I'm looking at it, and there are a lot of big wins and a lot of big losses. There are not any close games. There's like a handful of close games. Like, this is a team that needs to win some close games. You can't just put up an 8th spot every game and move on, because you're going to find teams that can also do that.
Yeah, that's and that's unfortunately, I think, where we're at here. I mean, we're still talking about a first place team, but, you know, we were talking about a first place team for almost 40 days last year, too. So,
we were. And Atlanta is a game and a half. Like, it was behind. There was about a three and a half game gap.
That was, you know, that wasn't like a really deep insulation against division rivals or anything. It was enough. I think anybody, you know, you get excited when you have a lead in the division that will take more than one evening to change positions. But at the same time, you know, yeah, this being in first place doesn't free you from A, the things that are wrong with you, and B, criticisms of those things. And you know, I don't think it's being overtly negative to say that this team doesn't look like a first place team when it loses 3 out of 4 games, when nothing is working, and with the best of the NL about to toast
to
them.
Stop on them like they're tiny little tiny mice, and it's, you know, the beanstalk giant.
Yeah.
Listen, it is early in the morning when we're doing this. We're lucky I'm able to string a metaphor together.
Do you think Scott Kingery's fabled return will turn things around for Phillies?
It can't hurt. I mean, it might not help, but it certainly can hurt.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Cesar has been very good at the plate. He has sucked out loud in the field. He has been so bad, like to the point where it's like really, really noticeable. Yeah, like it can't happen. And I think like 9 times out of 10, the Phillies, you know, Gabe Kapler and Matt Klentak, who, you know, Klentak is making a lot of decisions. I think 9 times out of 10, they're going to take the offense. And so unless Kingery can come back and start hitting, they're going to keep, I mean, I still think that Cesar is going to get the majority of the starts over there, because I just don't see them passing up his offense when the team is having so much trouble with it. Cause you can overcome a bat, you know, an error that leads to a run when the dude gets to the plate next and actually hits a home run. So.
Yeah. I look at Cesar Hernandez and I mean, it's pretty obvious right now that he's looked able to hit the ball, but in the field, he's been a disaster. But not just like, he's been a very distinct disaster. I've seen stats that indicate he's really picked it up since Scott Kingery has gone down. Like his offensive stats have really been, he's really turned it around. But when he makes a mistake in the field, it's not even like a normal error. You can see a guy like stringing it together a few bad games in the field and committing a few errors, but like there's almost like no excuse for the kind of mistakes you see.
No, there's really not. That's the difficult part, is that it really feels like we've got Scott Kingery out there, like, but Scott Kingery over at shortstop. It's like shortstop Scott Kingery is actually at second base.
Yeah, it's very not pretty.
Not what you want.
You see that from a starter, and then see also, you know, the other night during this Brewers series, Gabe Kapler decided to give Phil Gosselin and Sean Rodriguez some playing time, and I believe it was against Gio Gonzalez. He didn't like Michael Franco's numbers against Gio. He was like 1 for 24 lifetime against Gio Gonzalez, so he stuck Sean Rodriguez at third. He got Phil Gosselin in there, and you know, I get that. That's part of that's just like, oh well, we got to keep these guys a little warm if we plan to use them at all, and clearly we've had to use them already. So let's keep them a little loose. But in doing so, you know, you're once again seeing the Phillies' lack of depth, which they really, I don't know if it's that dramatic across the league, the difference between the talent from your starters and the talent coming off your bench. But it seems like it's pretty steep drop off for the Phillies.
Yeah.
Especially in the case of, go ahead.
I don't know if it's as steep for other teams. It feels really steep for us because of the talent that's on the team. I think whenever you have to replace a starter, you know, whether in the rotation or, you know, a position player, it's hard. But I think also, like, the Phillies have some long-term attachments to guys that they're not quite in the win now mode where they're ready to just cut bait with these guys. Like, letting Aaron Altherr go was a big deal because it took a lot for them to do that.
Yeah.
A long time. And so, like, you look at some of these guys like Nick Williams, who I love, and I think they need to keep because they need an extra outfielder. But, you know, they've had an attachment to him for several years. Like, what are they doing with him?
Yeah. And I mean, in the case of Altherr, it was like, it's time to move on. Like, the move made sense. When you don't have room, you don't want to have to play a guy who's unable to keep up with major league pitching, unfortunately. I mean, we were all waiting.
The perfect place for him.
Right. I mean, we were all waiting for Altair to find that groove again, and he just never did. And, you know, you need that space for someone who's going to be a little more productive.
Modern John Mayberry Jr.
Unfortunately, you know, the rosters still had, you know, the Phillies bench makes it almost laughable that, like, you have to watch a guy who was once considered so promising in Altair go to another team while, like, Sean Rodriguez is out there not stepping on third base on a play with the bases loaded where he gets a ground ball and then throws home. Another bizarre defensive play completed-ish by the Phillies. But again, I brought that up as another example of, yeah, the Phillies have a lack of depth, and using their bench in Rodriguez at third over Franco opens the door to situations like that occurring more often. What are you most encouraged by about the Phillies moving forward? I mean, yes, we're looking at a team that doesn't look like it can hit, a team that doesn't look like it can rely on its pitching, either at the beginning or the end of games. I believe the bullpen has been better lately. I guess that has to be noted. You're about to face the best teams in the National League, and there's really no depth to tap into as far as backing up the starters. So, Liz, what about the Phillies are you encouraged by at this point?
That is a really good question. I'm encouraged by Gene Segura.
I thought you were going to say Gene Simmons, and I was like, that's an insane answer. Okay.
No, Gene Segura? Question mark.
Sure.
I mean, and Reese Hoskins his batting average has fallen precipitously.
Yeah, but he's still got the highest OPS on the team. Which is, you know, 954 after yesterday's game.
His Reese Hoskins batting average has fallen 30, 40 points in the last 10 days.
And, you know, Odubel Herrera.
Right around the time when we were ballyhooed, you know, all of the his consistency. I was fat, the new Reese Hoskins, the guy that doesn't disappear for, you know, weeks at a time.
Odubel Herrera has looked like crap.
Right after I bought a shirt of him, a Phillies throwback shirt. So I am at fault.
Cesar Hernandez makes mistakes in the field that are very Odubel-esque. I remember, you know, a couple years ago, before the anti-Odubel stuff was even really at its peak, Cesar Hernandez was kind of the Odubel Herrera in that he was the easy punching bag for media or lazy fans to really attack because he would make the most insane base running mistakes. He would make goofy defensive mistakes. And part of the reason he was, you know, the next year, part of the reason he was able to become like a top 10 second baseman was that kind of stuff stopped. Like that kind of stuff not only stopped, but people sort of forgot that even really happened. Like he locked it down. And even when he was committing errors, they looked like normal errors. But that sort of goofy Benny Hill music, Cesar Hernandez is back. And Odubel, maybe less so in the field at the moment, but at the plate, he is also back, which is more to be expected. The Odubel Herrera, who really doesn't look like he goes up with a plan, flails a lot, swings at pitches way out of the zone, lets pitches in the zone just come right by, like that kind of stuff. And that happens with him sometimes. But like the difference between me and someone who hates Odubel Herrera is that I'm happy to admit how frustrating and terrible he looks when he is at his worst. We know that he goes from extreme to extreme. But it's impossible not to admit or acknowledge how bad Odubel looks when he looks bad and how much.
There are times I think he makes up his mind to swing before the ball leaves anyone's hand. Like I can almost see him doing
it, mouthing out loud to himself, "I'm gonna swing this time. Here we go, swinging, about to happen. Swing, engage, go now." Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And someone who hates him will just use that as ammo to continue hating him. But, you know, when he's hitting hustle doubles and triples and everything, that's, you know, that stuff doesn't count for him. But yeah, that's kind of been it's the story of the Phillies right now, is that everyone who's capable of being looking bad at their worst is sort of at their worst at the moment. Reese Hoskins has disappeared. Herrera's swinging at everything. Cesar's dropping the ball at the plate and in the field. Bryce Harper striking out all the time, historic levels. McCutchen unable to carry the team all by himself. His sinking in numbers isn't, you know, you would think that would be happening at a point where other, you know, people in this lineup would be able to pick him up, but nope, everyone's just falling apart together. And Michael Franco, who we were so encouraged about.
Oh, he's falling way off, making me look like an idiot.
He's falling way off. He's down to hitting .238. You say Gene Segura because really he's the only one in the lineup who seems capable.
He hit a home run yesterday.
Capable of anything, which
I remember that.
You know, it's good. We love Gene Segura. You know, I like every one of these players in this lineup for the most part. And I have to point to the potential of this team, because when they're all slumping collectively, yeah, it's hard not to think of this as a bad team. And yeah, I don't think they, if this is the sort of team they are, a team that can win, but also loses, almost as much getting pounded a lot, then yeah, I'm not so sure that I can call them a good team either. But people who, there seems to be an ongoing pattern of like, Bryce Harper is striking out a lot. I told you guys he wasn't good. Or Cesar Hernandez is looking really bad out there. I never agree he was a top 10 second baseman. There's just a lot of like, people just need to
self-congratulations on disbelieving and being the angry voice when everyone else was happy. Like, do you think anyone who was happy about Bryce Harper thought, yep, he's going to be good forever, no problems ever again? Bryce Harper doesn't think that. He knows he's going to go through some shitty periods. He's going through one right now. Like, him being on the team is about a whole lot more than him individually doing well. You know, we all know he came to Philadelphia to have spend the rest of his career. He's aware there's going to be up and down because he's played baseball before and he's older than 10. So, you know, those people, I want to punch them in the face. Like, the concern trolling about Bryce Harper's numbers right now make me just want to hulk through the virtual halls of whoever's doing it right now. Like, lately it was Joe Posnanski, who is a hack and can shut up. He's written some beautiful things, but his time has long since passed. Like Bill James and Rob Nyer, he can also just shut up, because a lot of what he, like, his whole thing about, is this the real Bryce Harper? Should Phillies fans worry? Like, that was all about proving that big contracts are bad, and these players shouldn't be paid a lot. Like, it's about justifying people not spending money. It's really, it really feels like that's what, because why else are people going in on him so hard? Because you can't do that to Mike Trout, because he got that big contract and he is literally the best baseball player on earth.
Oh man, if anybody went after Mike Trout, they'd have to deal with the collective fathers of every baseball sports writer in America coming to his defense. They love their Mike Trout. And we're gonna dig more into this when we come back from the first break. Yeah, so we're on continued success talking about the Phillies' struggles at the moment. I promise we're going to get to the chronicling of the 10-year anniversary of the 2009 Phillies team, like we do every week on continued success. But
which might be a little bit more uplifting than what we're talking
about.
We've
opened a can of worms here, and I think we should dive right in. First of all, yes, I too love the people, and I know I brought this up, but you expanded on this a little bit. The people who see a Phillies player struggling, who everyone who was at one point celebrating, and use the opportunity to say, like, I never believed in that player, and that always cracks me up, because you're just dealing with people who are like, elbowing into your exchange to announce that I have never enjoyed a baseball game. How about that? It's like a
many of our precious commenters on the Good Fight, who we love each and every one of you, deranged folks.
It feels like a contest to determine who has enjoyed the Phillies least over the past 3 years.
It's always been like that too. I mean, even during the lean years, but during these, I mean, people were lining up to say, I knew it wasn't going to last. I can't believe it lasted this long. I knew the Phillies weren't going to, you know, in 2011 when they lost early and it was painful, there were people then saying, I knew this was all going to come to an end. I knew that they couldn't do as well. And we're just like, they won 102 games. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. And I mean, that being said, it's super fair to be discouraged and upset by this team after dropping three or four to the Brewers. But I know,
but you don't have to be so stereotypically Philadelphia about it. It's a choice we can all make to not be that way.
I mean, everybody can feel and do whatever they want. I'm just saying it cracks me up how quickly there's this mix, this combination of emotions of like, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, but I want everyone to know how smart I am. And I don't know if there's an adjective that describes that emotion yet, but it's the only one some people feel after a series that the Phillies lose like this. And I never believed, ever. I don't believe in anything because then I can be right.
Exactly. Like, it's a combination of wanting to steel yourself to possible disappointment. And once you do that, you're like, oh, well, I did that, which means I was right. And they were bad. Instead of thinking, I just was protecting myself from feeling joy or sadness. Now all you're doing is getting your joy from telling people how sad you are.
Yes. It's the age old formula of if I stay a critic of the team forever, then I'm either going to be pleasantly surprised when they succeed, or I get to say I was right.
Well, and you get to always be right. If you're going to be a critic of the team and that's all you're going to be, you're always going to be right. And that's why people do it, because there's always going to be something wrong. Unless they win the World Series, there's always something that's holding them back, that's going wrong, whatever it is. Like, that's the joy that people, not just, you know, Phillies fans, but Eagles fans and fans of every team. Those constant naysayers are doing this because it's a guarantee that they're always going to be right. Optimism is not always rewarded, but thinking the worst almost always is, because there's always going to be something wrong.
I don't remember the last time a player was good and then fell off and then stayed off for a while. And like some national baseball writer was like, all right, I got to hand it to, Philly cheesesteak guy 6969, he called it by saying Bryce Harper sucks with 24 exclamation points, a couple of months ago. You know, he had the scoop on the fact that Bryce Harper actually secretly sucked, and the rest of us didn't have that. So shout out to my man and solid analyst, that handle I just said. So I don't know what the reward is for that, really, but
it's self-satisfaction. Yeah. And it's just internal, because, and it's just about this one part of your brain about being right and telling people that they were wrong, because you don't get any pleasure out of the baseball. You just get pleasure out of, quote unquote, owning other fans with, you know, being shitty.
Yes. So really a lot of this, like, has to do.
Optimism is frowned upon. And I refuse to let go of my optimism.
Well, this was always going to come back. This culture, this widespread culture of negativity. Well, it was always going to become vocal again. I think a lot of people shut up about the Phillies, obviously, when they were bad. The signing of Bryce Harper sort of introduced this team into a new era and made this a whole different situation. I think a lot more people are paying attention. A lot more people want you to know their thoughts about the Phillies. And Bryce Harper, you know, he has, I wouldn't say he's been a disappointment, obviously. He started off pretty hot. There's a game in Colorado when he went 5-for-7 at the plate and, his batting average jumped from 250 to 296 in a single night. And, that was probably the peak of Bryce Harper's Phillies career at the moment. Cause, it seems to have been a pretty sharp drop downhill from there. That being said, you know, he's still out there. He's making diving catches in the field almost every night, which isn't the sole contribution you want to see from him. But it's just a nice little indicator that, like, okay, the real Bryce Harper is still in there, obviously.
We have a real right fielder out there. Like, you don't have to just contribute with your bat. It's helpful. But, you know, Bryce Harper's a good defender. He's a good defender, and it's something that I don't think people have talked about a lot, and they weren't able to talk about it until he rammed into the bottom of that wall and then got up and walked it off. Like, that's kind of legendary.
Yeah, I mean,
because he did the same thing. He did the same thing like 5 minutes later.
And if he had, if they had won that game, or if he had won that game, then we'd probably still be talking about that. But that really got, you know, like that totally glossed over. And, you know, unfortunately, Bryce Harper being a Philly guy, hustling, I don't like, that's still a topic of conversation. And I guess at this point, even with like evidence like that, the kind of shit that Philly fans love, despite that, I think, and you mentioned this earlier, and I want to circle back to it, that the money has a lot to do with that. That people, everyone knows how much he got paid and how long the year is and how crazy, crazy of a contract it is. And they just view him as like almost like a sellout. But, you know, he's a sellout to the Phillies. But Philly fans are still just like, you took the money. Even though taking the money meant he came here, they still like hold that against him. I think I said that on Hitting Season, that in one of the pregame shows before a Phillies game, there were two guys talking about how bad his numbers were right now, and they are bad, and saying, at that point they were still like kind of fine, like the kind of numbers you'd expect to see from like Cesar Hernandez or Michael Franco a couple years ago. And they were like, yeah, you know, fine, not $330 million, fine. And I said on that show, he's never going to be a $330 million. What does a $330 million player look like? That's a guy from a video game who's programmed to hit a home run every three at bats. Like, that is the guy who steals a base and has a 100% success rate. There's no way any player on earth is a $330 million player. That doesn't mean he doesn't deserve the money the way the system's set up. That's certainly not what I'm saying at all. It's more just that, like, that's a cartoonish amount of money. And if you're using that to decide whether or not he's good, you're never going to think he's good. And I think some people never want to think that he's good. I think they just see the hair. They see the batting average. They see the deal, and they just kind of, yeah, they just sour on him because, I don't know, out of like resentment, out of jealousy. I don't know what it is. I don't know what honestly he could do to endear himself to the city more. Not only has he like vocally been, getting in with everything, like the city itself, the culture surrounding the city, fan culture, historical culture. He's super involved.
He's having a child in this city.
He wants to lay down roots in this city. And
his wife, God love her, who has never, you know, for better or for worse, has never had a personality, which is fine because it's not her that we've signed. She can have her own life. But when some woman tried to slide into Harper's DMs, it accidentally was hers and sent like a real ass forward picture of a woman, and like she posted about it, was right, it like did a little Instagram thing, and I'm like, I like that.
Wow, you that's know? That's pretty incredible. I did not share about that.
I don't know why, and I don't, it's one of those things, I think I missed it, and I would have like advocated to write for it on Yahoo Sports because I love stories like that about baseball player wives who allow themselves to sort of be in the background and don't, you know, feel like they have to have a real outward post. Like I had to write about Ben and Juliana Zobrist recently, who are divorcing, and she sang the national anthem at Cubs games and God Bless America. She does a lot of weird stuff. Her fashion is also weird, but she's very out there. And like not every baseball player wife has to be that way. And I like that you know, Kayla Harper is not that way, but would go on Instagram and be like, get away from my man.
Yeah.
And also suck at sliding into DMs because this is my account.
Yeah, seriously, get at least try to be good at what you're doing there when you're trying to.
He's Mormon. They are both Mormon. Like, reading about their wedding ceremony was really interesting because Mormon weddings, I find Mormons fascinating. Their Mormon wedding ceremony is like the two of them and their minister. I'm not sure what they call their religious clergy. But it was just like the two of them and the minister in like the big hall. Like, it's that incredibly private. And, you know, I think Kayla Harper did a thing with The Knot about their wedding. And I was reading about it. Like, she's a really interesting person with, you know, interesting viewpoints. I'd love to know more about her. But right now, all I need to know is that she wanted to slap down this woman who wanted to have sex with her husband. She's like, I'm carrying his baby, bitch. Come on.
Yeah. So, like, they've clearly.
Sorry, that wasn't about Harper at all, but I'm truly entertained by her. I would like. I kind of wish she would have more time not being pregnant, not as a mother in the city, just to sort of establish herself as a force on her own without a kid. I would have loved that. But, you know, they'd been married for a couple of years. They were probably getting ready to settle down specifically for this purpose.
Well, I feel like that's that's part of, I mean, everybody loves to see. I mean, I feel like we've had a couple of like player wives who did like make themselves known. And I mean, it just makes it feel like they're even more a part of the city and a part of everything. And I understand the things I'm listing aren't going to satisfy someone who's like, look, I'm pissed because this is a guy who's supposed to be the center of the offense. And he looks like a struggling bench player right now. Yeah, nothing I'm saying here is going to solve that. It's just more looking at the big picture here.
There's so much
on top
more.
Of the stuff he's done so and said more. Now he's also doing like Aaron Rowan type stuff, sliding into walls to make catches in regular season games, you know, healthy hustle, not the kind of hustle he had when he was younger player. And he was just like, I'm going to run into this wall to just for this play. And they're like, okay, but it was like
Muppet.
A ground ball to shortstop. And he's like, I'm going to do it anyway, just to show you how much I'm into this game. And you're like, okay, let's dial it back a little bit, give him a giant hamster wheel to try and run off some of that energy before the game. No, everything seems balanced at the moment. He's just not, hitting the ball and he's striking out a lot. I think it's ridiculous to assume he's never going to pull out of this or that this is just the kind of player he is. I think that being the most talked about story of the preseason this year, everyone was waiting for this. Everyone was waiting for his first prolonged struggle to be able to write about it. And that graduates it into an even bigger issue. Yeah, it sucks. No one on the Phillies is hitting right now. The offense looks really bad. Minus, I guess we got to say, Gene Segura. But yeah, the offense looks really bad and it sucks. You know, it's upsetting to be like, crap, another offense that slumps together, another offense that seems to shut down collectively and just render the team ineffective when the pitcher does anything but have a long quality start. I mean, yeah, it's frustrating because it feels like we're watching the same team as last year when we're actually looking at a roster that's so entirely different from last year's. And I think that's the difference, that this is a team of guys who are too good not to bounce back. I can't say this particular stretch of games is fertile for bouncing back, given how good the opponents are.
No, we should all just buckle down. It's going to get worse.
Yeah, look, this is a team that's, unlike last year, capable of pulling out of a tailspin. So I think we are going to see that eventually, but you know, it might mean the Phillies fall out of first place for a minute. It might mean they look really bad on this road trip and it's going to upset a lot of people. And that's totally understandable. Apparently we have a sea of absolute geniuses filling out the Philly sports fan population. So we'll talk about a different team, the 2009 Phillies, when we get back from the break. Well, Liz, one thing to recall about the 2009 Phillies team is that they were also far from dominant. A good team that really you couldn't rely on to just go out there and bash an opponent in every night. And frankly, from the 07 to 11 run of success this team had, there was really only one of those teams that really did fit that description, and that was 2011, a team that seemed to just win every series. They really didn't hit their worst patch of the season until the very end of the season, when I think they lost like 8 games in a row, but that might have been after the...
Oh, and they couldn't lock. They had either just locked up the NL East, or they had been trying.
But they were a hammer of destruction throughout the league all season long. Obviously, they had a pitching staff they could rely on, and their offense came through enough of the time that guys like Halliday and Lee could make a couple of runs stand up if they had to. So, but this team in 2009 was just another one of those teams that, you know, they were able to go deep because they were able to rally. They were very much a second half team. And you see that going through their schedule. You see that, especially in some of the early months of the season, they would start a month absolutely scuffling and then end the month absolutely dominating. They had a lot of questions, a lot of raw spots, a lot of muscle tweaks and strains, a lot of weak points that had been strengths the previous year. But the 2008 champions still existed within them. They were just being hampered by a bunch of X factors, which is why it makes sense to me that this team was devastatingly inconsistent in only extreme ways. They won in bursts and lost in streaks, typically with the front half, like I said, of the month being bad for them, and only to see them storm through the back end of it. So that's kind of what happened in May. We talked last time about how the Phillies had a strong finish to April, only to faceplant in early May. But this week, the good 2009 Phillies are back. And after going 5-7 to start the month of May, they turned things around in a hurry and finished the last 2 weeks of the month winning 12 of 16. This is, like I said, a second half team. No one knows why. It defies science. I mean, how does a second half team happen, Liz? The guys just like go in the all-star break or get halfway through a month, have a little talk with themselves in the mirror, come back out and know how to hit the ball again?
I don't know. I always feel like the all-star break resets people. I'm like, oh, families. I have a family. I don't have to go to work for 2 days, 3 days. Great. Like they go on golf trips. Like, and those 09 Phillies love to golf, man. I mean, baseball players in general love golfing. I feel like it's a little less today. It's more of a, hey, look, I'm golfing, you know, thumbs up selfie. But the 09 Phillies were golfers. Like Shane Victorino still golfs constantly over on Hawaii. So I feel like that they all reset a little bit. You know, maybe it's all just nonsense. It's all, no one knows why it happens.
A 10-6 win over the Nationals got the ball rolling for the 2009 Phillies in mid-May, thanks to a four-hit game from Raul Ibanez. And despite another brief, sad outing from Joe Blanton, whose ERA remained in the high sixes following this contest, the Phillies were facing John Lannon, a historical punching bag for them. And they were able to get a few runs across early enough so that when the Nationals punched through the bullpen and scored two runs in the bottom of the ninth, the score was tied at 6-6 instead of being a stupid loss to a terrible team. So into extra innings they went, pushing into the 12th before the Nationals handed the game over to the Phillies offense, which did its job. Three straight walks with one out loaded the bases, and the Phillies obliged Nationals pitcher Kip Wells with an Ibanez single, a double steal with a throwing error that let Jason Wirth score, and a Pedro Feliz double that knocked in Ibanez. This game was referred to as a baseball version of the carnival game Whack-a-Mole. So that's the level of grace and skill with which the Phillies were winning games at this point. A lot of scrutiny was still on the top hitters in the lineup who had all been dragging their feet to get going. And this game provided the narrative that they were all turning it on. Though it must be said, as it comes up in every episode, the reason the game was tied in the bottom of the ninth was due to Brad Lidge, who, instead of closing the game, opened the way for the Nationals, according to the Inquirer recap. So, yeah, I don't want to mention this every time, but it is hilarious how when you use broad descriptions of this team, or probably a lot of past Phillies teams, how similar it sounds to now, you know, the scrutiny on the top players in the lineup, the fact that they were all struggling to get going, that this team wasn't as good as they appeared to, this team wasn't looking as good as people wanted them to be, or that even that they realistically could be. I mean, again, this was the World Series champions, so expectations probably couldn't have been higher. You know, this was probably the year of this run when expectations were highest, dare I say it. I mean, I guess after signing Cliff Lee back again, expectations were sky high, so that might not be totally accurate. But in this case, the argument would be, yeah, 2008, they obviously won the World Series, but I don't know if they were necessarily expected to win the World Series in 2008. Now people had seen what that was like. They could see that this team could do that, and the team was largely the same team that had done that. So people were thinking, okay, what is why should we not be able to do this again? And, you know, the answers provided themselves pretty quickly, and it brought everyone back down to earth. I think everyone brought everyone back down to normal complaining territory. So they got to say, like, oh, okay, the defense of this is the same team that won the World Series a couple of months ago falls apart when you say, is it though? Because Cole Hamels looks really bad. Brad Lidge looks really bad. The offense isn't hitting. Finally, something to complain about. It's like breathing. Finally, we can breathe again in Philadelphia, knowing the team is worthy of our complaints. But they won that game against the Nationals. And wouldn't you know it, maybe these 2019 Phillies just need a big win against a shitty team to really turn things around. Well, I guess they just did play the Royals, so that might not be in the cards for them in the weeks ahead. Well, the Phillies also visited the White House and President Obama as the 2008 champions at this point. The president made the obvious, very generic point that I think every president has made before him. They had won so much despite no one believing in them, much like, you guessed it, his own presidential campaign. Obama compared Charlie Manuel losing his mother during the 2008 postseason with losing his own grandmother during his campaign. He also pointed out that the Phillies players, many individual charities, notably Jimmy Rollins and Ryan Howard, saying they were great role models for young black ball players, a demographic severely underrepresented in MLB to this day. Jimmy responded by trying to taunt the president into a one-on-one basketball game. Obama said, "I have a foot on you." Jimmy said, "Yeah, but I'm too quick."
Oh my God. Like, I just feel a love for Jimmy Rollins all over again. I didn't think that was possible. Like, wow. Everyone, by the way, if you have a subscription to The Athletic, use it to read Doug Glanville's piece, an appreciation of Jimmy Rollins and his career, because the two of them played together for a few years before Glanville moved on and then retired. So
yeah,
it's excellent to read about actual young James just being James. It's brilliant. Please do it. Jimmy Rollins is just a legend. I love him so much.
We recorded a new episode of The Dirty Inning last night that took place in 2005, and Trevor and I were joking about how, maybe our mothers could have played shortstop for this team because, you know, they were looking pretty bad at the point in the schedule that we were talking about them. And then I went back and I was like, wait, who was the shortstop in 2005? And it was, of course, Jimmy Rollins, as I feared. And I'm like, okay, so that was not an accurate statement, but it just goes to tell you how he was like 26 in 2005. He was in his prime. Or in 2007, he was 26. Sorry. So 2005, he wasn't obviously too much younger than that. I mean, this was like, you know, this wasn't like young Jimmy Rollins figuring it out. This was like mid-20s in his prime Jimmy Rollins, I don't want to repeat myself here, but it was surprising for us to learn that Jimmy Rollins didn't make an All-Star game after the year 2005. He was in no other All-Star games after that. He won the MVP in 2007, and all the guys behind him in the MVP voting were All-Stars that year, but not Jimmy.
Wow.
It's bizarre. Isn't that bizarre?
It is. I mean, the Phillies were stacked, and so...
And there was Jose Reyes, and I remember I guessed Jose Reyes and J.J. Hardy were also in the NL at that time, and they both made the All-Star team in 2007, but the eventual MVP, Jimmy Rollins, did not. And he also won a Gold Glove and a Silver Slugger that year. So, yeah,
Jimmy. It's useless. Let's just remember this.
Jimmy's been around for a while, is my point. And he had campaigned for Obama, and when pressed as to why he would go out of his way to mix sports and politics, as if it's at all avoidable, at all avoidable to do so, Jimmy said, according to the Inquirer, "Sports and politics, they tell you don't do it, but at the same time, I'm a U.S. citizen first." So, and that's like kind of the, once again, Jimmy sort of sums it all up. I mean, that's, yeah, it's an unavoidable intersection, and we're not going to get into a whole thing about it. Lord knows we've talked about things of this nature more than enough on this podcast, and I'm sure we will again. But I felt like that was a really succinct way of saying, like, look, man, this is unavoidable that sports and politics are going to intersect because these are all Americans or people who spend a lot of time in America, at least, playing baseball. They're going to have thoughts about things. They're going to, some of them are going to want to be more active in what they believe in. And, you know, regardless of what that is, it's going to happen. So making the argument that sports and politics should be separate is futile and frankly pretty dumb. Jimmy was always going to do what he felt was right, and that in this case included campaigning for Obama at that point. And I feel like that they needed an explanation for that is silly, but he gave them pretty much the simple explanation that question deserves. So reporters continued plucking at the Phillies about politics, with one columnist trying to get a quote from Brad Lidge about Obama speaking at Notre Dame a little later amid protests about Obama's stances on abortion, Notre Dame obviously being a Catholic college. Lidge is Christian and a Notre Dame alum, but he answered as kindly and ambiguously as you could imagine. Meanwhile, saying like, oh, you know, I believe people should protest what they believe in. But also, you know, it's the president, he's coming to our campus, like this is a big deal. And I've met him and he's a nice guy and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, as diplomatic as you can imagine a wonderfully nice person like Brad Lidge being when asked a question like that, that is designed to get him to say something that will get people talking. Meanwhile, the Phillies swept a doubleheader after their extra inning win the previous night. And in doing so, being the Nationals twice in one day, in doing so, they had to tap into their depth. Andrew Carpenter was brought up from AAA to make a start. And because of that move, the team sent Miguel Cairo to the minors, having a need for better bench options as well. So the cupboard was a little thin at this point. Carpenter managed to avoid a full-on blowout in his game two start, but he didn't last five innings and allowed five runs and eight hits in the Phillies 7-5 win. So again, we're talking about a team that looked good, but didn't seem to be hitting their potential. Offense wasn't doing it for them, and a very thin bench, as well as a rotation they couldn't rely on. So boy, I don't know if all these teams are the same or if we just happen to pick teams that sound like the other teams we're talking about.
Baseball, there are only like five things that ever happen in baseball, and they'll just happen over and over.
That I think is accurate. There's only five things that happen in baseball. Yeah, I could see that. I don't know. Yeah, we might have to change the number a little bit, but I think that's totally an accurate statement.
Yeah, like I just picked a number out of the air, but that, you know, somewhere around there, there's like just five or six original things that happen in baseball, and they all happen over and over in different ways to different names on different teams.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned player wives earlier. Heidi Hamels hosted a charity event at the Please Touch Museum around this time. She and Cole had begun their philanthropy efforts and were working to provide AIDS relief in Africa, something else that was noted by Obama during his speech during the Phillies' visit to the White House. Heidi was asked, of course, to throw a baseball for some reason, I'm assuming for the photo op, and she reportedly threw a 46-mile-an-hour heater while wearing a formal cocktail dress for the cameras. It's a pretty cool picture. I was in the paper.
Yeah.
I was like, that's sweet.
Heidi Hamel seems a little weird. She's always struck me as where she's a Survivor alum. Mm-hmm. Being on Survivor kind of puts you into a class of people who are seeking some kind of reality show fame. I'm surprised and delighted that they are still married.
Yeah. And they do a lot of good work too. So, you know, I think it takes a special gene to want to be on reality TV, you know? So I think she possesses that, obviously. But hey, you know, it's tough to argue against the kind of work they've done for Philadelphia and overseas and just in general, you know, that's one of the more prominent passions off the field passions of any former Phillies player at the moment. I mean, that's you know about that is, and that's like for a charity, that's pretty, for a player's charity, that tells you that we've heard a lot about it over the years. So, a blanket had been intended to be a Mother's Day giveaway featuring the likeness of Jason Wirth, in mid-May, obviously, so that arrived and the Phillies opened the boxes to discover that Jason Wirth's lips were a bizarre shade of hot pink in the image. So the Phillies came out, they decided that was not going to be dispersed to the audience. The Phillies gave out vouchers instead for women 15 and older to come back in late July and pick up their Jason Wirth blankets when they would have the right color lips. In the meantime, people sold their vouchers online, some for over $100 for people who just really wanted a Jason Wirth blanket. I realized I have the Chase Utley version of this. It was like the Jason Ooh. Wirth blanket giveaway sponsored by Motrin. And I was like, oh yeah, I have a Chase Utley blanket with his like fuzzy likeness on it with a big Motrin logo in the corner. So I wound up with the Chase Utley one of these
fuzzy likeness
somehow, even though I am not a woman 15 years or older. So don't know what happened there. So the Nationals the Phillies would sweep the Nationals in a 3-game series at the end of the month of May, beating them. So they beat them 4 times in this series, once in a doubleheader, and then again would sweep them 3 times or in 3 games at the end of the month, beating them in 7 straight contests. I took a roundabout, complex way to say that they beat the Nationals 7 times. Don't know why I had to complicate that. They actually wouldn't lose to Washington again until September 10th this season.
Oh, those go, were the days.
Right?
God damn.
They'd go 15-3 against them for the season. Their four-game sweep on the road was the team's first since 1995, according to the Inquirer. Chan Ho Park did not put the Phillies in a position to win, lasting less than 2 innings. The Phillies' best pitcher of the day in the series finale was probably Jesus Colom of the Nationals, whose throwing error allowed the tying and winning runs to score in the 7th for the Phillies. With Blanton's struggles and Chan Ho Park's nonsense, the sight of Jay Happ as savior became a more and more common talking point. Hamels was obviously a problem, and Jamie Moyer had been getting blown up in his last 3 starts. Somebody had to be looking at Happ like he was the ghost of a little boy who was going to steal their job, or at least they should have been. The Phillies stayed on the road, though, heading to Cincinnati for 3 games where they stayed hot, winning 2 of 3 and improving on the road trip to 6-1. We talked about how eventually Hamels would make a good start in 2009, and writers would rush to assign it as his possible turnaround. His start in Cincinnati was exactly that. He went 6 innings with 7 strikeouts. That was enough for people to be like, okay, nobody say anything. I mean, we're obviously going to say everything, but like, this could be that maybe Cole Hamels is back. Even Brad Lidge got a save, just to put a little bow tie on that narrative. The Phillies finally pulled the trigger on some rotation changes. Happ did replace Park, who would become a long reliever in the pen. Meanwhile, Happ being interviewed about the swap after being frustrated by losing out on the spot, the 5th spot in the rotation in spring training, he couldn't help but show a little smile despite saying, you know, I don't want to comment on that. I respect my teammates too much. Like, I'm just, you know, I'm happy to be able to contribute more, but you know, I don't want to like make it sound like I'm dunking on Chan Ho Park or anything. But that didn't stop his former fellow bullpen arm Scott Air shit from shouting traitor while he was being interviewed. I love Scott Air. He came back for 2008 alumni weekend. They put him on TV, clearly drunk. Guy who knew he was one of those guys who was never really supposed to be there in Philadelphia when they won a championship, but he just wound up there, and he did really well when he had to, and he earned the ring just like everybody else. So Scott Air, really laid back guy, who I've always been entertained by. After Cincinnati came a series with some dark foreshadowing as the Phillies headed north to Yankee Stadium. But we can talk about that next time on Continued Success. But I felt like that's going to be a fun series to talk about. Fun-ish. It was certainly more successful than the last time the Phillies played the Yankees in 2009. But it provides you with some of the narrative foreshadowing that we all love and, you know, find in hindsight, but obviously didn't exist in the moment. In any case, Liz, we got, you know, a full week of the Phillies playing tough teams ahead of us in 2019. So, I mean, is there anything you're going to use to stay positive in the week ahead?
The fact that eventually this run of games will end.
Ah, boy, we are already there. You
eventually
know,
it'll be over and we'll be able to say, hey, that happened.
Before we get accused of being too negative, I'm going to say, I think they sweep the Rockies. I think the Rockies pitching has stumbled too much this season. I think the Phillies are going to be able to take advantage of, they're playing in Coors Field, right?
No, they've already done that. Haven't they?
Oh, you're right. They already played in Coors. You're right. So they're back home in Philly. Regardless, I think the Phillies are going to be taking advantage of a rotation that's been struggling. And this is at least going to be more of a bash fest than the last series. I think these two teams could really take a few chunks out of each other. And hopefully I think the Phillies could take a bigger chunk out of the Rockies. So I'll say that. I think that's
I hope just that because happens.
It feels like we're due.
Yeah.
But in any case, don't forget to listen to all your favorite Phillies podcasts that are part of the Good Fight Podcast Network, including Hidden Season with John Stolness, obviously Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and The Dirty Inning with myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk. We've got a lot of new bonus content hitting the Patreon. It's patreon.com/hidden season, as well as a new Dirty Inning episode. Like I said, takes place in 2005. And I only, you know, talked through one of the points we talk about on that episode. So really, you could still listen to 3/4 of it and hear brand new information, frankly. So no reason to ignore that. In any case, thank you
Thanks for listening to Continued Success, and we will talk to you next time.